Well, this is Dr. Stan, right here at the Avery Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, of course, they're going to be the views of for the next hour of Rosalind Peterson. And we're going to be talking about weather modification. Now, most people find it very difficult to believe that there is a capacity to change the weather today, and yet here in California, do you realize that a month ago we had 2,000 wildfires burning? We still have about several hundred wildfires still burning because of the unusual dry weather we've had in the Middle West. They've had excessive flooding and really interfered, at least in some areas, with the planting of the crops. And then, of course, we find this is true throughout the world. Why is the weather changing? Well, certainly we have weather cycles. We've seen this in the past. But is there the ability by government programs to create a change in the weather? Well, certainly you go back and you read Zygmunt Bzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, and I've commented on this before. It was actually written in 1970. Zygmunt Bzezinski, one of the most powerful men in the world today, has been until recently the foreign policy advisor for Obama, Hussein Barack Obama, but Barack Hussein Obama. But anyway, of course, he's sort of trying to get a little in the background because this simply shows that Obama is under the control of the same people who controlled John McCain, and we really don't have much of a choice. But back in 1970, Zygmunt Bzezinski wrote a book entitled Between Two Ages, and there, at a footnote, at somewhere between page 75 and 75, why, because he talked about how in the future we're going to be able to create storms and droughts and create new chronic diseases. We're going to be able to create storms and droughts. Anybody who wants to see the pages will be glad to copy them and send them to you. Of course, you can buy the book up on the Internet probably for a couple of $100 or so. They've jacked up the price of the book because the last thing they want is for people to know what Zygmunt Bzezinski was writing about in 1970. And, of course, that was because of that book that Bzezinski was selected by David Rockefeller to form the Trilateral Commission, certainly one of the most important and powerful covert organizations in the world today. Well, with us, of course, is Rosalind Peterson. We're going to talk about weather modification and how it impacts on you out there in the listening audience. Rosalind, thank you so very much for being with us.
Welcome, and thank you for having me on the show.
Well, we had you on in the past, and certainly we all enjoyed it. We just want to get you on again. Why don't you tell our listeners just a little about who you are and how you got interested in this subject?
Well, I live in Northern California, and I'm formerly a United States Department of Agriculture crop loss adjuster. I worked for the Mendocino County Department of Agriculture here in Mendocino County, and I've had a big, well, I spent my whole life, let's put it this way, dealing with agriculture. I grew up on a working farm. And what got me interested into this subject was, starting in 2002, I began to find that there was sharp tree declines, and I began to find that there were a lot of things going on in the atmosphere, man-made, that didn't look right to me. And so I decided that I would start an investigative process, which I did. And since that time, I have been working very hard to find out what's been going on with the weather.
And, of course, there's a lot of information out there. You just got to know where to look for it and know where the reliable sources. And so we'll be giving you some of those sources later this evening, and I think you'll enjoy our conversation with Rosalind. They're not going to tell you, the controlled media is not going to tell you about weather control and weather modification. What is not imaginary, it's not kooky, it's really very real. Well, Rosalind, go right ahead, and you pick up the story there.
Well, when I started taking a look at what was going on in our skies, I was seeing more persistent jet contrails. I was seeing these contrails turning into man-made clouds. And it was strange not to have our deep blue skies anymore all of the time, but be hazed over or whited out. So I started investigating, and my investigating led me to NOAA and NASA and several other government agencies. And what I discovered is that there was a lot of atmospheric testing programs going on. I found that there was a lot of weather modification programs, over 60 across the United States that I can document from NOAA under public records.
Now, what is NOAA for our listeners?
NOAA is a combination of, it's like an umbrella agency for the National Weather Service. It works with the Air Force in other words, different atmospheric heating and testing programs. NOAA goes into the marine, in other words, it talks about marine life. It studies lots of things, sends up satellites, and it's an umbrella organization that really has a lot of effect on our climate and on our weather, does a lot of studies. They have a jet airplane, for example, that's specially equipped, that flies all over taking air quality samples and doing other, you know, in other words, when they run a test, why this jet is sent to those places to see what they can find and the results of the test. So,
now, NOAA really stands for National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Association?
Yes, it does.
Okay, fine. I'll have to admit my producer put that up on the screen, but
that's
the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association. NOAA, most people have never heard of it. You're not supposed to hear of it, ladies and gentlemen. Everything is done in secret, or perhaps it's there. You can find the information, but, of course, if you're not looking for it, you'll never be kept aware of the fact that we are financed in this whole program to alter the weather. So pick the story up from there.
Well, what takes place now at this point is that I find out that there's a whole lot of weather modifications ongoing and that NOAA has a list of them, not the military ones, but has a list of these programs. And when I started to look, I found that they were ongoing in places like California, Texas, Idaho, Montana, all these states, Colorado, for example, Wyoming, are all doing weather modification programs. And what happens is that private companies can modify your weather without your consent. They don't have to notify the public. They don't have to notify
anyone.
Hold that thought.
We'll be back here in just a moment. And Kristen Roslin has been talking about NOAA, which is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, NOAA. And, of course, they're a government agency. They basically cover, a number of very specific departments. But she's been investigating. And you go to NOAA and you investigate NOAA, of course, you get into all these 60 or more different programs that they have that influence the weather. You pick up the story, Rosalind.
Well, once you get into these different programs, you find out that private companies can modify your weather without your consent. A private individual can modify your weather, and they don't have to tell the people who live under these weather modification programs that it's even ongoing. They don't announce it on the news. They don't tell you that there's a weather modification project underway. There's no government oversight. There's no public oversight. So they're totally unregulated, and these programs are ongoing. So the public not only is unaware of the programs and the scope, some of them cover 184,000 square miles. And this is not the total of the program. This is how many square miles it covers. And 184,000 square miles is bigger than a lot of states. And what they're doing is, for example, in Wyoming, they're putting more snow in the Wyoming mountains than ever before. And once they started to do that, they started to have droughts in Colorado. And in the first year, they had drought in Oklahoma.
You would think that they'd be smart enough to know if you took the moisture out of the air in one area, why you get the droughts in another area. But they don't seem to be concerned about that, and they certainly aren't telling the farmers in Colorado, because a lot of them are very concerned about the drought.
They're not telling the farmers anywhere. They're not, even in California, they're going to put a big new program to get more snow into the San Bernardino Mountains. However, they don't tell you that that's going to take moisture away from the croplands in the Central Valley and other areas in Southern California. So each program has an equal and opposite reaction. If you put more here and you steal it from one place to put it in another location, you're going to disrupt the microclimates needed for agriculture, trees, everything to survive. And you can only put up so many programs. And so a lot of times weather modifiers will say, well, we don't know if it's successful, we don't know if it works. But they do know it works because a lot of the weather modification companies, and there are many of them, do weather modification not only across the United States but worldwide. So they know it works, but when you start putting more and more programs up, then the likelihood that it's going to work or have opposite reactions to what you wish it to do is going to occur. And so you can have a reaction where you get too much rain. You can have a reaction where you get, in other words, more snow than you thought you would. And you can have a reaction that it would melt quicker than you thought. So you can have adverse reactions to all of your programs. And so in Wyoming, they had flooding because the snow in 2006 melted too fast. So you can have these reactions to your programs as well. And the public isn't told. They aren't told, in your meteorologists never talk about this. And they never tell you that there's a weather modification going on and that you're going to experience more rain today. They just tell you, oh, it's a normal weather system. Well, I'm less and less likely to believe that because of the scope of the weather modification programs that are ongoing right now that we know about.
Well, you know, this is really rather frightening because, of course, this is going to have a profound impact upon many of the farmers, their livelihood. And I know that certainly in Colorado, a lot of the farmers are very, very concerned about the drought. And apparently this is eastern Colorado, and they don't know what they're going to do because they can't irrigate their fields. How do they have the right then to interfere with God's plan for what's going on and to benefit one group over another? And really, this could lead to the economic devastation. Many of the farmers, by simply stealing the rain that they would have ordinarily had.
They don't have the right, but there are no laws in effect to stop them.
Well, isn't there some sort of a coordinating organization here in the United States, or is there?
No, there's no coordinating organization in the United States. Anyone can decide to modify the weather. Peter Cordani, who's a private individual with Dynamat Corporation, decided that he was going to use a chemical that he invented to clean up spills on the floor in stores and shops. And it's a powder, and you drop it on the spill, and it absorbs all the moisture up in a powder, and then you can vacuum it up. Well, he took this stuff up into an airplane, and he seeded clouds with it, and the clouds dissipated. So now he's out trying to put this chemical into hurricane to stop hurricanes and doing other tests, and he's involved with other government agencies and a university at this point, and he's just a private individual. So if we can be experimented upon by private individuals, the chemical he uses is highly toxic to fish and marine life, and if it lands on the ground as a powder, then when it rains, that powder turns into, in other words, will seep into your drinking water. Animals will pick it up. So we have serious questions about the type of weather modification that is going to happen to us in the future if we don't stop some of the bills that are in the works, like Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison's bill, U.S. Senate Bill 1807, which could be passed at any time, which even allows for military weather modification. And there's no public oversight, no warnings, nothing.
Well, what part do you think that the weather modification may have played here in California, where we've had such an intense drought that's led to such intense fire and fire problems?
I think that when you start modifying the weather and surrounding states like Nevada start to modify the weather, what happens is that it has a drying effect. And in other words, instead of the rain spreading out, raining normally all over the state, it begins to be concentrated in certain areas. In other words, they have it snow in one place, they can have it rain in another place. And so what happens is your water distribution over the state begins to change. The agents they use, they can dissipate clouds. See, that's the thing, that if clouds were going to come through and rain, for example, in Mendocino County, they can put a powder up and dissipate the clouds over Mendocino County. Therefore, they stop the rainfall from being here. And that's critical that we have the rain for our agriculture and our trees and our watersheds. So when you start to talk about, well, we're going to take it and we're going to put it in the mountains somewhere else, then you're going to have the drought and the drying factor that's going on because they're altering our weather.
Well, now, they're doing this primarily by spraying various powders and things of that sort. Are they doing this with HARP? How are they going about modifying the weather, as you described?
Well, they can use ground-based chemicals like PG&E does. In other words, they can use a ground-based type of application where they shoot things into the air, and or they use different sized planes, and they can take these planes and fly them overhead, and they can use everything from the old-fashioned silver iodide up to more sophisticated chemicals and alter the weather. So the different types of planes and the different types of applications used individually or together are tremendous.
Well, now, where could our listeners out there who are skeptical about this sort of thing, is there any website, is there any place they could go? Would they go to NOAA? Does NOAA have a website? How could our listeners out there who say, well, this really couldn't be true, how could they get more information on this subject?
Okay, they can go to CaliforniaSkywatch.com, which is my website. And I write articles for newswithviews.com, and I've written several articles on experimental weather modification for newswithviews.com. And if you click on my name, Rosalind Peterson, the articles will come up and you can read them. And at the end of the articles, there's links. All those links link you right into documents, link you right into information about weather modification. There's a link that will even give you a list of the programs for the last 4 years that are ongoing in California and other western states. So you can, there's lots of access, and they will take you to NOAA, they will take you to NASA, they will take you to the Air Force, they will take you to a lot of different places, university studies, so that you can look at all the documentation for yourself and read articles about it. And you can go to KTVU.com, which is Channel 2, out of Oakland, San Francisco. And if you look up weather modification on that channel, they had a program last Monday night talking about just the weather modification going on in Northern California and China. I was interviewed for that program, and all of the information that I gave them about these different programs they used on that program. They even talked about how they interviewed a variety of people on that program, even meteorologists. And what happened is they admitted that even persistent jet contrails can modify the weather, and they did say that and agreed that that was true because NASA studies show that. So we have not only chemically induced weather modification by states and private individuals, we have other programs ongoing where these persistent jet contrails turn into man-made clouds, and NASA says they exacerbate global warming and they also change our weather.
No, I'm sure they do. And, of course, our guest is Rosalind Peterson. So you could go ahead and put her name in if you have access to a computer. You just Google in Rosalind Peterson. Once again, your website, Rosalind?
It's CaliforniaSkywatch.com.
CaliforniaSkywatch.com. What about here in California? You know, what about this dry lightning? I never remember dry lightning ever before producing so many fires. What's that all about?
Well, I looked up lightning on the NASA website, and there have been some lightning experiments.
Hold that thought. We're going to be right back again here. at Radio Liberty. Rosalind, you go right ahead and pick the story up.
Well, I did do some research about lightning, and I did find out that there have been some lightning research. Eglin Air Force Base in Florida has done some lightning research, and that was on a Science Channel program, and they noted that. And also, I had never seen thunder and lightning strike our county anything like it did, and all of Northern California, like it did on June 19th. And I can tell you that it was the strangest lightning. It shook the house. It rattled windows in many counties, not just in Mendocino, in parts of Mendocino County. And this lightning was so tremendous that it was like having almost like sonic booms from the old days or an earthquake where it just hit and it would go bam. And it was scary. And many counties had 5,000 or 6,000 strikes. When on a normal year, you can look up your county and you can look up your state, and you can see the number of lightning strikes per year. And we would average about 14 to 20 per year, and pretty light, and mostly associated with rains. But this strike came in, and there was no rain to speak of except in just a couple of small isolated areas. Most of it was dry lightning, huge bolts hitting the ground. People weren't safe in their cars, and it set so many fires. There's thousands of fires burning in Northern California since June 19th, and it was stunning. And the breadth and scope of the lightning was stunning. And I really feel that, I can't prove this, but I really feel that we were underneath an experiment just because of the unusual nature and the rotational cycles of the thunder and lightning around us, that I really felt that we were in some sort of test pattern for about 24 hours maybe.
Well, Chris, a lot of people are going to say, well, that just sounds like crazy talk, but people have to understand that they have been experimenting on this for years. And there's a wonderful report that came out of the Veterans Administration back in 1994, dealing, of course, primarily with the Gulf War syndrome, but also going into the fact that our veterans, our people, even the general population has been used as experimental guinea pigs without their knowledge or consent for many, many years. We call it the Rockefeller Committee Report. It doesn't deal with lightning, but it does deal with the other macabre experiments that they've been performing. So if you're interested in, of course, getting the Rockefeller Committee report, why, it's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I think it's vitally important that you understand, ladies and gentlemen, they're experimenting on our troops over there. They during the first Gulf War, they used all sorts of experimental vaccines, and that's why so many of the veterans of the first Gulf War came back ill. That's why so many have died. In fact, the number who have died is just frightening. We have the statistics from last November where of the original 650,000 healthy young men we sent over there, predominantly almost 80,000 were already dead by November, and a lot have died since then. Experiments, but without the knowledge of the American people. But if you want to document what I've said, the Rockefeller Committee report, if you want the report from the Veterans Administration, which will never be discussed here on the radio, we have it. We'll make it available to you. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris, we asked Rosalind about the strange lightning storms we had here in California starting in June. And Rosalind, of course, says that up there where she lives in Mendocino, there were all sorts of lightning strikes, and she had never seen lightning strikes like this before. And in her county, there were statistics on how many lightning strikes in the county. There might have been, 15, 20, somewhere in there?
Somewhere in there, 50, somewhere between 12 and usually about 24, 25 strikes.
And how many did we have this year? Do you have any idea?
I'm not sure of the exact number because it's varied, but they say somewhere between 5,000 and 6,000 strikes. strikes?
5,000 and 6,000 strikes. And, of course, this is what caused all the fires that have devastated California. At one time, we had over 2,000 fires burning at one time. And most of these came from the lightning strikes and, of course, the dry weather here. And it's Rosalind's contention, although she can't prove it, but it looks like another macabre experiment they're carrying out. What about HAARP and the High Altitude Auroral Research Project? What part does that play in changing the direction of the jet stream, and how can that be used to modify the weather?
I've heard it said that it can, but I don't have the documentation that I need to really go into the HAARP program as far as their capabilities, because since 1990, they have, or 1992, they have enlarged the HAARP program in Alaska to, and it's a high altitude auroral research program. And I don't know exactly how sophisticated or what they can do, because they keep it pretty well classified.
Well, why wouldn't they let the American people know what they're doing?
Because if we did know, we'd say no, because we're playing with our ionosphere and the upper atmosphere, and this creates problems for us. And one of the things that I really believe it creates is that we're modifying the atmospheres in ways that could damage the fragile environment, in other words, the stratosphere, the ionosphere, and there's different layers around the Earth that protect us from harmful UV radiation, that protect and allow life to be sustained here. And when you start to superheat it, which I do know they can do because they've made no secret of that, Bernard Eastland, the patent holder, has talked about what the capabilities of HAARP many times, and he's the patent holder for that particular project. But what happens is that when they superheat this atmosphere above us, they have no idea if they could break down, in other words, this protective shield that covers us. And so the experiments are really experiments that could damage this fragile structure. And we don't know if they've damaged it already. We don't know all of the experiments they're conducting. Now, we do know that NASA and the Air Force have joined together to send up canisters filled with chemicals like barium, lithium, strontium, and SF6 sulfur hexafluoride, which is highly toxic and polluting. And these chemicals, when the canisters go up either on the space shuttle or on rockets, what they do is they superheat them, and these explosions that are created in the ionosphere and at different levels above us create these chemical reactions. And they're studying that to see what happens when they do that. The only problem is that I think those chemicals are showing up in our drinking water supplies and spiking. And I also believe that that also interferes with, in other words, the protective shield that covers the Earth. So there's a lot here. I have a lot of studies on a lot of the information about what NASA and the Air Force are doing as far as those types of tests. And I'm concerned because in California I have the results of all of the drinking water tests for the entire state of California, dating back to the 1970s from the California State Department of Health in Sacramento.
And what are they doing to our drinking water?
Well, we're having unusual spiking in aluminum, barium, manganese, magnesium, and some other chemicals. And what happens is these are mostly the chemicals that they're using in these atmospheric tests. So I'm concerned that our animals and our crops, everything is being affected by these spikes way over state and federal standards of these chemicals.
And, of course, certainly these things, aluminum is a toxic metal. You know, it produces Alzheimer's disease, related to Alzheimer's disease and other dysfunctions of our brain. And barium certainly is not good for you. Magnesium is not so bad. I mean, we need magnesium. But what they're doing, these people are playing God. They're all experiments, all in the name of science. And that's, of course, when they're producing new diseases. It's all in the name of science. But between man's plan and time and God's plan and eternity, there's an infinite, quality of difference. We're going to be back in just a moment with Rosalind Peterson, and we'll welcome your calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course, Rosalind has done a great deal of work on what's going on. Of course, all we know is that the weather is changing and changing dramatically, and certainly we've never had the lightning storms like we've had recently. We've never had a drought in California like we're having today, and we've never had the flooding in large parts of the country and extensive droughts in much of the farmland. Does anybody have the right to disturb the weather? Well, apparently there are no laws. Is anybody concerned within the government about what's going on? And you must be getting some information. I'm so pleased that Channel 2 up there in the Bay Area was willing to carry your program. But what sort of response are you getting? What are people doing about this?
I get a tremendous amount of response from people who never knew that this was happening. In other words, this has been kept under the radar for a long time, and so no one knew. They don't talk about it, and so in exposing it, people are becoming more and more concerned about these programs, and they're starting to raise questions. They're signing petitions. We're going to go up and take thousands of petitions up to the governor's office in Sacramento, Governor Schwarzenegger, up to his office actually next week. So we're doing any number of things and encouraging people to sign petitions and to contact us. And we're mobilizing to begin to fight here in California especially against any more of these programs and the initiation of new ones until we are informed about the impacts that this is having on our trees and tree health and the microclimates. All things in California, every city, every county has different microclimates. And these select individual climates allow the crops in that region to grow and proliferate. And when you start to change the weather artificially, then you disrupt the water and the climate in those microclimates. And this is going to decrease crop production extensively. So it's good to raise the issue and let people know, especially farmers who depend on the weather, to produce crops that our food supply. And if we don't step up to the plate and say no to these weather modification experiments and no to Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson's bill, U.S. Senate Bill 1807, then we're going to lose the ability to produce crops because the experiments will get more extensive and more pronounced with their impact.
And I really think, that, Chris, that people are going to have to get educated on this subject. And as incredible as it may seem, they really have the ability to modify the weather. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Rosalind Peterson. We're talking about the ability to modify the weather. And, of course, certainly by modifying the weather, they can wipe out the farmers in any part of the country they want to. And there is legislation being put forward by Kay Bailey Hutchinson, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson. They want to set up sort of a committee to study this sort of thing and to regulate this. What basically would they be doing? And of course, would they focus public knowledge on the fact that there are these programs to modify the weather and create some of the drastic changes we're seeing today?
No, they set up the bill itself sets up a group, and the people within this group are ones that want to do weather modification. And there's really no member of the public that is going to be put on the oversight group for this. It's going to set up, in other words, and allow for military experimentation. So it's funded. If they pass it, it will be funded so that they can experiment. But there's no public notification. It doesn't even include congressional oversight on their programs. Congress can be notified, but notifying Congress doesn't mean that there's going to be oversight or public notification. And if we already have 60 of these programs, then why are we initiating more programs to disrupt our climate and the weather even more? That's my question.
Well, of course, we're hearing that the Chinese are planning on going ahead and begin to use these programs to clear the air in preparation for the Olympics. What have you heard about that?
If you go onto the internet, China weather modification, they're experimenting because their air quality is so bad, but it doesn't seem to be working at the moment very well because they have so much air pollution there that I don't know if they can rein it all out, because they built their industries to be very polluting industries, and so they would have to almost shut them all down because they don't have rules like in the United States. Now, whether they're successful or not with their programs, I don't think we're going to know. I don't know that they're going to tell us. But we have American weather modification companies in 50 countries around the world modifying the weather. And I am clear, after talking with them and seeing some of the results, that they can definitely modify the weather. Now, I don't know if we're in China, but we are in other countries.
And, of course, the implications of this are overwhelming, because, of course, what they do is they modify the weather in one area, they modify it in many other areas as well. And so you may get paid, and you may want rain, or you may not want rain. But what is it going to do to the next state or the next community away from you? And so what we're really doing is we are unleashing forces. We have no idea what the ultimate implications are. We saw this here in California, or really all across the country, when Congress, in its wisdom, of course, authorized, in fact, mandated the use of something, an oxygenator in gasoline, either ethanol or MTB, and so we put MTB by force of law into our gasoline, and what happened? Why, of course, we pretty soon had contaminated the water supply and the air with a carcinogen. And then, of course, they had to spend billions of dollars to pay off the lawsuits. And whatever these things happen, there's a law of unintended consequences. Now, of course, they mandated the production of ethanol and introduction to corn ethanol, putting it in our gasoline. And that's driving up the price of animal feeds and certainly many of the products that come from animals. Many of the farmers are now, because they can't afford to feed their hogs, they can't afford to feed their beef, they're slaughtering them, their dairy cows. And so these things sort of build one right on the other. And what are the implications of the things that Rosalind is talking about? What implications is this going to have on our crops? And right now we know that at least in certain parts of the country, there are real problems. And a lot of farmers, of course, if they can't produce crops and they put them in, they're going to go bankrupt. And then what's going to happen to them? And let's go to Mike, who's calling from Santa Cruz. Again, our guest today is Rosalind Peterson, and her website is at skywatch.com or .org.
It's CaliforniaSkywatch.com.
CaliforniaSkywatch.com. But just Google in Rosalind Peterson, you'll come up with it. Mike, do you have a question?
Yeah, two, actually. Now, it wasn't Kay Bailey Hutchinson, also the EPA administrator, that said the air was safe to breathe at the World Trade Center?
No, that was not Kay Bailey Hutchinson.
Okay,
that was the woman who was in charge of the EPA.
Okay, yeah, never mind. I'm really wondering about the connection, or a possible connection, between aluminum in chemtrails, which we've been hearing there's a large quantity of, and the lightning strikes. Aluminum being electrically conductive, would it tend to draw the lightning to the earth more often? Because it's one thing to have more lightning than usual, but then it's another for the more lightning like that to be hitting the ground as well.
When you add some chemicals to our air supply, you can make a volatile cocktail. I don't know how much is in the air at any given time. It's hard to say. So therefore, I wouldn't be able to answer your question, although I do know that if you have enough, enough chemicals in the air, the atmosphere can get very conductive.
This could
lead to an increase, but I'm not a scientist. I don't know enough about it to tell you too much more than that.
I'm thinking of the aluminum that would have been settled onto the ground from months and years in advance of the lightning.
Well, Well, we're finding a lot of aluminum in drinking water supplies and in soil samples. And what happens is aluminum is a fire hazard, along with the other chemicals I named, because mixed together they form almost like an explosive fireworks explosion. So when you get a lot of chemicals that are fire hazards on the ground, your forest fires, when they catch fire, can all of a sudden burn hotter than ever before and can be very explosive in, as a mix. So the last thing you want to do is put flammable chemicals in your air supply and in your soils due to the detriment impacts when there is a fire.
I think that's a very, very valid point. And, of course, they're having such a terrible time controlling the fires here in California. We have never, and I've lived here for 79 years, we have never seen anything like this here. Have you ever seen anything like this before, Rosalind?
I can say that I lived here my entire life, and I have never seen anything like this.
Okay, fine.
You know, you would have a few, you know, a little roll of thunder and a couple of strikes, and then that would be it, but not when you go into thousands and thousands of strikes, and never have I seen it in so many counties in one, you know, in Northern California, just never.
And, of course, we're seeing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of acres burning here of the forest, and the fire control crews, even with the help of the National Guard and the military, cannot put them out. I mean, they're having a terrible time getting these strikes surrounded and stopped. So something is going on, and I don't believe, of course, they're going to tell the American people. After all, think of the implications of all those people's houses being burned down just because they were doing just a little experiment here, and oh shucks, we didn't mean to do any harm. Government never means to do any harm. Mike, do you have anything else before we let you go?
Enough for now. Thanks a lot.
God bless. And thanks very much for your call. And certainly, are there any of the legislators up there in Sacramento who have any idea what's going on? I mean, the idea that people can actually modify the weather is so foreign to our thought process, because ordinarily the media does not cover this. Now, I'm so pleased that this was well covered on Channel 2. I really applaud the people up there, because so often why the people in television are not allowed to put this out. Obviously, somebody there believes your story, is putting the information out, and you say you've gotten a tremendous response from people as a result of that program?
As a result of that program and also my writings for News with Views, more and more people are putting the pieces together across the United States and figuring out that this isn't normal. So what happens is there's beginning to be a groundswell. It's been slow at first because people were kind of shocked. And then as they read about the programs and I sent them the list of programs, which I can do for anyone if they want a list, when I started to send out the list from NOAA, and when I started to talk about this, I mean, there's even when I spoke at the United Nations last September, on this subject, people were shocked. They didn't know. It's like opening a door, you know, or a window, and all of a sudden letting some fresh air in about what's going on. And so I've had responses from people around the world as well as from California and other states. So it's been quite interesting to see that there's been an awakening of what's going on.
And, Doctor, for our listeners out there, an excellent source of information, and one I, of course, check with every day, is newswithviews.com. That's newswithviews.com, put out by Paul and Lorraine Walters, and they do a great job. And of course, you can read Rosalind's articles there, and this is one reason I was, of course, encouraged to get her back on. We had her on one time many years ago, but we wanted to get her back on because, of course, she's on the cutting edge of what's going on. And think of the implications. If you're out there and you're in the listening audience, and so often you find out that when you talk to people and you try to tell them what's going on, why they sort of shrug or their eyes glaze over and they change the subject or they call you a kook or something of the sort. But here's something that affects everybody. And, of course, these fires are devastating as far as the loss of property is concerned, and certainly fortunately there hasn't been a great deal of loss of life, but the destruction of the forest, the destruction of homes, and of course the countless hundreds of millions of dollars that have been wasted fighting these fires. And I'm not saying they shouldn't fight them, but if these are the result of simply some little experiment, and we know that they're experimenting, this is the thing, we know they're putting these sprays up into the sky. Now, is the spraying pretty responsible for some of these chemtrails that people talk about?
I don't know, because there's so many different programs ongoing. I couldn't tell you what any particular jet was releasing, except for jet fuel emissions, water vapor, which is a greenhouse gas, and ice crystals. I can't say that any particular jet is spraying anything. However, what I would like to say is that growing up here almost all my life, jet contrails never persisted as they do today. And starting around 1988 or 89, that's when people first began to notice that the jet contrails were larger and persisted for much longer periods of time than ever before. And I believe that there was a change, and I think that along that time period, around the late 1980s, is when there was money, and a lot of these different experiments started to really go into full force. And so my inclination here is to look at just forest fires alone. And in 1988, there was a program, there was a big fire, and in Yellowstone National Park, and it was a tremendous fire, and it was the first time that they ever talked in the history of the fire, you know, all the fire fighting groups ever talked about mega fires. And since that time, they talk about mega fires, and this is fires which burn hotter and higher into the atmosphere than ever before historically known. And firefighting had to change all of its techniques and what they did, because they started, after 1988, facing what they called these mega fires, in which every fire that started began to burn at higher altitudes above the earth, in other words, and the heat intensity was so much greater. And my guess is that when they started to use atmospheric experiments and these various chemicals, which are highly flammable and toxic, I think that they're floating around in the atmosphere and saturating the soils, began to have two effects. I think, one, we started to see tree decline because aluminum was getting into the soil. And when you have more acidic rain, aluminum is absorbed into tree roots. When that happens, trees can no longer absorb moisture and nutrients to survive, and they die like they're strangling to death. So we began to see, in the late 1980s, this sharp tree decline across the United States, which is documented in Charles Little's book, The Dying of the Trees. And there's other documentation showing that trees really have started to die in many areas of California and having unusual symptoms. And my guess is that as you saturate the ground and the air with chemicals that are highly flammable, like aluminum and barium and manganese and magnesium, those types of chemicals which they're using in these atmospheric experiments, shooting them up in canisters and then exploding them, as you saturate the earth, these fires have turned into megafires. And so you have a declining tree population and bushes and shrubs declining all over the state of California, for example. And then you add to this toxic mix coming down that saturates the soil, the tree leaves, everything, and you strike a match. It's just like having gasoline fumes, and you strike a match and it explodes. And I think that that's part of what's going on. And it seems like when you test the soils and you begin to test for these chemicals, they're finding them in the tree rings. They're finding them in soil samples. And we're showing these unusual spikes in our drinking water supplies.
Now, where is the environmentalists and Greenpeace when we really need them? Well, let's go to Jeff, calling from Yakima, Washington. Jeff, did you have a question for our guest?
Oh, I do. Interesting show as always. Mine's a kind of more from a health slant, and I'm not sure, Rosalind, that this is something that's, but with the aluminum that you said in the chemtrails and what you just said about the megafires and aluminum being in the soil and everything, I'm a physical therapist. I work with the elderly in nursing homes, and I see Alzheimer's dementia all the time, and I know that high content of aluminum in the body seems to be a recurrent factor in that, and I'm wondering, have you seen or heard, or is there a relationship that might be linked to this?
Yes, I think that as you increase your exposures, and if you look at your, if you look at the studies of the increase in Alzheimer's, and you begin to look at the dates that it started to increase in the United States, kind of like looking on a graph and all of a sudden it starts up sharply, it starts up somewhere in the late 1980s on a much sharper incline, and it's been kind of escalating since that time. And I think that some of our experiments, atmospheric experiments, are exposing us to different chemicals which can react with the body.
I think, Jeff, you have to understand it's not just aluminum. It's aluminum, fluoride, mercury. It's a series of toxic metals. We've got a great four-tape or four-CD set on Alzheimer's, unlike anything you've heard before. And there's a definite relationship between these chemicals that they're contaminating our water and our soil and our food, and they know exactly what they're doing. At least I believe that they know what they're doing. Because after all, aren't there too many people in the world, Jeff? Don't we need to do away with a lot of them? There are people who feel that way. Hey, we're out of time, but God bless you. Thanks so much for calling, and we'll talk to you real soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dr. Stan.
Well, Rosalind, you got 3 minutes to wrap the program up. It's been a fascinating, fascinating program, but you got 3 minutes here uninterrupted by me.
Oh, well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me on the show. It's appreciated very much.
Well, Vinny, I'm going to try to give you a call off air and try to get you onto our other programs. As you know, we actually had to, we have 4 different audiences every week, and, of course, you're such an articulate guest, and we would want to get you on our afternoon and certainly our morning programs and our weekend program as well, but you go right ahead.
Well, what I would like to say is that you can go to my website, californiaskywatch.com. It has my email address, my address, and I'd be happy to get petitions to you to sign, because we have to stop these experimental programs that are going on, atmospheric programs. We have to get a grip on this, because if we don't, it's just like when people talk about persistent jet contrails and see them cover the sky, turn into man-made clouds and white haze. If you go to the CDC records for a lot of these health effects, and if you go for, in other words, looking at the increase in rickets, it's a lack of vitamin D, and it's a disease in children and now adults, a lot of these things trigger like the fires around the late 1980s, when a lot of these experiments really got the funding and started going full force. And by 1990, 1991, and 92, these programs, and many of them you can find on websites, you can find in my documents. And what it is that they tell you what's going on. And we need to begin to talk about these programs and let our elected officials know how we feel about it, sign petitions, and begin to really demand that they put a stop to these, because we don't know what the synergistic and health effects are. We know that health problems across the United States, respiratory problems, in other words, even vitamin D has been related to other, lack of it has been related to other types of problems. So what we need to do is we need to start to really join together and become a fighting force, because no one can do it alone, and we need all of your help to step up to the plate as well.
I agree with you totally. And Rosalind, I think what you're doing is so vitally important. And, you know, we're just privileged to have you on one subject, that you know this subject very well. And fortunately, we have so many other things that are going on that affect this. But I'd hope our listeners don't get overwhelmed. We're the majority. All we need to do is get the information, get it to the others. And when they realize that their lives and the lives of their family are, of course, in jeopardy, and you're absolutely right about what they're doing as far as vitamin D is concerned, because it does help cancer. Anyway, we're out of time. God bless. We'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course I hope you enjoyed our interview with Rosalind Peterson. If you'd like to get copies of the tape, why, of course, they're available through Radio Liberty. We have an excellent four-tape set on weather modification, and it's been going on for a long time. We actually have the Rockefeller Committee report I've mentioned came out of the Veterans Administration. I talked to the woman who did the report for the Senate Veterans Committee. She was afraid to come on to my program. But it's an excellent report, and we have it available. We have four tape sets on HARP, High Altitude Auroral Research Project. Two four-tape sets on chemtrails, and, of course, that excellent four-tape set on weather modification. And you really need to get the information, the four-tape or four-CD set on Alzheimer's disease, because, of course, this is going to affect many people in the audience today if we don't put a stop to what's going on. We have the book, A HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, done by our friend Jerry Smith, and then his other book on weather warfare. We have a DVD, Bob Fletcher's excellent DVD on weather modification. And so now you just ask for Bob Fletcher's DVD. Basically, you have to understand that there really are people out there who are modifying our weather. And I believe that these people know exactly what they're doing, because I think they have a different agenda. I believe that there really are people out there who believe there are too many people in the world. And, of course, if you haven't seen my talk called None Dare Call It Genocide, or my DVD entitled Planned Population Reduction, you need to get it. You need, of course, to actually this week on WorldNet Daily, they featured an article on the Georgia Guidestones, this satanic monument back in Elberton, Georgia. And apparently some of the people there are getting involved, and there are even organizations wanting to tear down this satanic monument. And there are the Ten Commandments that come from the pit of hell. You can go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, and read about the Georgia Guidestones. And point number one, first commandment in eight different languages there, engraved into the stone, is maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. Maintain the world population at 500 million in constant balance with nature. And what they're really talking about is eliminating over 90% of the world's population. And people say, that's crazy talk. Well, it may be crazy talk to you and I, but you see, we look at the world differently than they do. Because in all probability, this monument was put up by the Rosicrucians. Nobody really knows who put up the money. Nobody really knows the secret society he represented, but he admitted he represented a secret society that wanted to leave a message for humanity, and he called himself R.C. Christian. Was that for Rosicrucian? Who are the Rosicrucians? What's their tie-in to modern-day masonry and the theosophy and to the occult? Why, they're simply one of the myriad of organizations that are carrying on the tradition of the ancient secret societies and the mystery religions. Now, of course, you can learn a lot about this and from my talk on the forbidden secret, or my more recent talk, Secret Knowledge. They're all available from Radio Liberty. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I do want to mention I've been offered by Tom Reed, who runs the American Christian Network up there in the Great Northwest, an opportunity to be on the afternoon program on KWT there in Spokane. We do need to raise funds if we're going to do it, and we do need to have funds raised for, you know, for say 3 or 4 months until we can build up a listening audience for that afternoon program. It'll be 5 to 6, be drive time. But what a wonderful opportunity to reach the people in the Spokane area. So if you live there and you'd like to see us on in the afternoon, of course you get a different program than you get in the evening that you're listening to now, why, give us a call at 1 800 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I believe that, of course, Tom Reed's American Christian Network is having a profound impact upon the people in that area. When people hear the truth, they recognize it. The trouble is they don't hear the truth very often. Well, of course, we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and put in a prayer for Tom Reed because he's doing a wonderful, wonderful job. And we'll be back in just a moment here for the next hour of Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to deal with what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And for the next hour, we're going to have our good friend Ralph Epperson. And Ralph has been one of those people like myself who's dedicated their lives to trying to bring out the truth about what's going on. And Ralph has written extensively on Masonry, a wonderful source of information on the Masonic movement in the United States. And I consider Ralph a friend. We've only met a few times, but we've talked for many, many hours on the telephone about various aspects of what's going on. And Ralph, of course, has put out a new DVD entitled $10 Gasoline. Well, of course, I believe that the probably $10 barrel gasoline, I believe probably a little bit more than that because of inflation, but the rise in the price of gasoline was simply created, I believe, of course, the fall of the price of gasoline recently has been created. It's amazing how so many people, who are just so furious with gasoline at $4.50 a gallon are so relieved when we get it down to $3.99 or $3.90 a gallon. Isn't that wonderful? And yet, of course, the price should be so much lower. But it is not. This is a manipulated commodity. There's plenty of oil in the world. But the last thing the people who control the reins of power want is for you to understand that you've been manipulated, that ExxonMobil made $11 billion in the first quarter of this year, more money than any other corporation has ever made throughout all recorded time during the similar period. And, of course, the other major oil companies, Chevron, and, of course, British Petroleum, and certainly Royal Dutch Shell. They're all, of course, in this. Those are the four big ones. Conoco is there as well. And, of course, there's Total over in France. But, of course, all these tie into what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness, and all of them are benefiting. But I believe, of course, somewhere down the line, the price of oil is going to come down. Why would they want to bring it down? Very simply to destroy competition. They've done this over and over again. And when, of course, people began taking a look at that, why, we can get $140, $145, $150 a barrel for oil. We're going to go into the oil business. And that's the last thing that the elite want. They don't want competition. They want to destroy competition. But let's get Ralph's view on this, because he's obviously put a lot of thought into it. Ralph Epperson, so good to have you back again on Radio Liberty.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Stan. It's good to see you and good to talk to you. And it was a pleasure seeing you in Santa Clara a few months ago.
Right. Well, it's the same. We didn't have more time, but that was a pretty pretty busy time. I just come back from marrying off one of my granddaughters, and I didn't get there until late, and I had to leave early. But anyway, let's talk a little bit. But it was good to see you as well. Next time, maybe we'll get a chance to put in more time together. You can come down to beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and spend a day with us.
Okay, we'll be happy to do that next time we work it out.
All right, but right now, let's talk about your new DVD, $10 a barrel, or is it $10 a barrel gas oil?
$10 a gallon.
Right.
I believe the price is going to go to $10. In fact, I originally intended to show it was $15, and I still believe that, but I thought, well, maybe I better temper this a little bit.
Oh, it's $10 a gallon gasoline, okay.
So that's what it is.
All right,
that's
fine.
What I think it's going to. And, and there's a very, very important reason for that I've discovered, and we'll reveal today. It's happening by design. Our government is in collusion with the Seven Sisters who own OPEC, and they own the oil industry in those non-OPEC nations that we're buying our oil from today.
Okay, I won't disagree with you there. I think it's all certainly contrived. But you go ahead with the story. Hold on that though. We're going to have to take a little break here, and when we get back, we'll be talking with Ralph Epperson, certainly one of the patriots who's been on the front lines of this battle for years, trying to educate the people that everything's manipulated. Go right ahead, Ralph.
Well, I just want you to know, Dr. Stan, this is happening in front of our very eyes. Every day in my newspapers, we have two newspapers in Tucson, the morning, and then I guess call it an afternoon. They're both owned by the same company, but we get a little different slant in the news, some of it anyway. But every night, there's another article about how prices are going up, businesses are closing. In fact, the U of A football team is trying to raise money for the season tickets, and they talked about how 30% less this year than last. And the fellow that even was commenting on it for the purpose of the paper made the comment that the what he called discretionary spending was going down, which means that the people are paying more for their gasoline, and they're taking money out of their discretionary spending, which the terms we'll define in a few minutes. And to do this, and that's exactly what I said in my DVD that I put out about three or four weeks ago, something like that. It was done right after I got back from Santa Clara. Dr. Stan, let me start with this. What prompted this whole thing, this whole study, this whole new DVD, was an article I was reading, and it was published in January of 1977, and it quoted a congressman by the name of John Ashbrook, a Republican from Ohio, who was really truly one of the very rare, I believe, true conservative congressmen. And he entered it in the congressional record, and he pointed out that the United States government was restricting our access to oil by doing four things, actually named about a dozen, but these are the four major ones, and I couldn't understand some of those. There was oil depletion allowance and things I didn't understand. But he said that the government would not allow onshore drilling, not allow offshore drilling, no more new refineries, and then four, they were restricting the amount of oil products they could make with the existing refineries. Now, the purpose of that was to force reduce the amount of American production and get us into foreign oil. And we're going to now talk about why is our government doing that and how. That's what we're going to talk about. Now, to start this whole thing, because I believe that John Ashbrook was right, and the thing that bothered me was this, Dr. Stan. He gave that speech in 1976. That's 32 years ago. And he could deliver the same speech with the same correctness today, which means for 32 years, nothing's changed.
Well, he could, except he died. It's amazing, of course, what happens to conservative Christians working within Congress. He just bled to death. Now, nobody believes to death from a gastric ulcer. I can hardly ever remember anybody, except this very prominent congressman, very outspoken congressman, supposedly bled to death from a gastric ulcer. But go ahead, he's no longer with us. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Ralph Epperson's here, and of course, he's talking about an article he read back in the 1970s by John Ashbrook, who was a conservative congressman, talking about the fact that we had plenty of oil. The government would not allow the offshore, onshore drilling. It was restricting the number of refineries that could be built. I just might, as a side, point out that we used to have about 340 refineries. Now we're up to about 150 or 140. Why would we be having left refineries where we did 30 years ago? Because of government restrictions, of course. And, of course, the government works with the oil companies. The oil companies don't want any competition. Competition brings the price down. Monopoly brings the price up. And who's making fabulous profits? Well, anyway, John Ashbrook was writing back there in the 70s about the fact that there was plenty of oil, we weren't allowed to develop it, and nothing's changed. Isn't that right, Ralph?
That's exactly correct.
Go ahead.
And that sounded to me like there was a government plan, a government program, a government platform. And as they were doing this, and it was being done for 32 years. Now, why? That also means that the Democrats who have been in office didn't change the policy. The Republicans didn't change the policy. That implies that both parties are controlled by the same people. In this case, the oil industry. And that's exactly what Bill Clinton told us back in 1992 when he gave a speech at the Democrat Party, that night of July the 16th, 1992, when he talked about who the two people were that got him into politics. Now, I know you've discussed this a thousand times, Dr. Stan, and we've even had people who want to become experts on Dr. Quigley, but I want to get into him because it's very, very important that we summarize what Bill Clinton was taught by Carol Quigley, one of the two men that Clinton praised for getting him into politics when he gave his acceptance speech the night of July 16th, 1992. Let's go back now and remember a couple of things about Bill Clinton. He went to school in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and got out in 1964. And he went to Georgetown University for 4 years and graduated, like most people do, in 4 years, from 64 to 68. And then when he was in, and by the way, he praised Dr. Carol Quigley that night in his speech to the American people with all three networks covering it live right in your face. I've got clips of him actually saying it, so we know that he said it, and then he put it in his own book called Putting People First between pages 217 and 231. Now, we know that. I've got a copy of his book, and I read it, and we're going to quote that very succinctly. He said briefly something to the effect, I'll do it from memory just to save time looking through my notes, something about the effect that I wanted to praise two men or recall two men who got me into politics. One was John Kennedy, and the other was Dr. Carol Quigley, a professor I had at Georgetown. Now, we know that he was there from 64 to 68, and we know that Dr. Carol Quigley wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope, published in 1966, which was right in the middle, approximately, of Clinton being there from 64 to 68. Now, that book was published, and we know for certain that it was required reading. I have a copy of the Georgetown Alumni Magazine for 25 years later, 1983, I think it was, et cetera, in 93, said that the book, Tragedy and Hope, was required reading for his students.
And of course, it should be required reading for everybody in the audience as well, because it's really one of the most revealing books that we have. It was suppressed for many years. A Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, is available from Radio Liberty if you'd like to get it. Remember, this book was actively suppressed. We have an interview with Professor Quigley where he tells that story, and you can get that as well if you'd like. Go ahead, Ralph.
That's correct. Actually, all of what you said is true now, but we know that Clinton read it, and I read it back in the 70s. As soon as I was made aware of it, I bought a copy. I was told that and I think you just confirmed this with your interview with I believe it wasn't you interviewing, but someone else was, and it's on tape, and you found it, that Quigley admitted that the Macmillan and Company, or whatever it's called, Macmillan something, publishing house decided to destroy the plates and pull the book off the market.
Well, actually, somebody bought up McMillan, and then they destroyed the plates of the first half of the book, and then, of course, they refused to reprint the book, because the last thing they want is for the American people to realize that there's a secret society working right here in Washington, D.C. Secret society working in Washington, D.C., and Professor Quigley on page 950 talks about how he had the opportunity of going through the secret records of the secret society. But, you know, if you were to call Rush Limbaugh or any of the establishment commentators and mention this on nationwide radio, they would cut you off so fast and make your head swim, because they cannot let the American people know what Professor Quigley said in that book that's had such profound impact on William Jefferson Clinton. Go right ahead, Ralph.
Okay, now let's remind your listeners that Clinton was taught that both political parties were controlled by an international Anglophile network. Now, that would confirm what John Ashbrook said, because Ashbrook said that for 32 years, well, he didn't say it because he was said in 76, but we can infer from that for 32 years, neither party has changed the oil policy of the United States government. So that obviously means that Quigley was right, that both parties are controlled. I'm going to give you some other examples of it just in a few more minutes. So now, Quigley pointed out that they were international in power, and that they had already controlled the economies of the world, not just of some nations or the West nations or the East or the West, all the nations. That's repeated twice in Quigley's book, and I believe that statement is true and remains true even today. So that's going to play a very important role in what we're going to talk about. So there was a conspiracy. Dr. Stan, you know this. They call us conspiracy theorists. That means that conspiracy is a theory, unproven. But Clinton is not a conspiracy theorist. He's a conspiracy realist, because he admitted it was real on live national television and made that comment in his book. So he's a conspiracy realist. Now, he went on to point out that this conspiracy also controlled. Well, wait. Before I get into the next step, you mentioned briefly monopoly. Let's define that, because it's very important that we understand there are two different types of monopolies, and there's two different types of cartels, and we have to understand that, and because that's how the government got involved in this process. John D. Rockefeller, as you know, back in the 1860s, I believe it was, founder, somehow got control or at least started some oil business with Standard Oil and became a what they call a robber baron. He took over the oil industry. And he got government concessions to assist him with contracts to reduce the amount of freight he had to pay on the ships, trains he was hauling, using to haul his oil from one part of the country to another, etc. But let's talk about the word monopoly. Economically, it's a very simple little word, but it's got a very secondary importance in a definition that is further important than even the first. The first definition of monopoly is one seller in a marketplace. So that means that man has the power, because he's the only one selling that particular product in a marketplace. He's got the power to raise his prices above and beyond what is considered normal or, you know, reasonable. Now, when that happens in a free enterprise system, the way to destroy his natural monopoly is to compete against. You've already said that. So that's the way you destroy a monopoly. So then he decided, well, wait a minute, there's got to be a way to stop competition. And he did, because there's a second type of monopoly called a coercive monopoly. And that's where the government make certain that you are the only one producing that product in your marketplace. A good example of that would be a taxi cab company. Here in Tucson, there's only one taxi cab company. It's a coercive monopoly, because they and the government are colluding to restrict access to the streets for anyone else who wants to hire or transport people for hire. So it's a coercive monopoly, and the government is directly involved. Now, how do you break a coercive monopoly? It's very difficult to do. You've got to get control of government and then void that contract. Just say, we're going to allow free enterprise to control who gets picked up and carried in the city of Tucson or any other city. Now, when the oil industry got so big and became nationwide, the three major oil companies at that time, the largest of the three, formed a cartel, and Quigley taught Clinton about that because it was in the book Tragedy and Hope. And those three cartel companies, by the way, let's define the word cartel. I guess that would be appropriate. The word cartel is defined as two or more sellers in a marketplace. And once again, there's a natural cartel and a coercive cartel. A natural cartel just works because there's three in the city, and they collude to set the prices, and then they can be destroyed by competition.
But, of course, with a cartel, they don't want competition, so that the companies collude with one another to prevent competition and to fix prices. That's what a cartel is.
Well, yeah, but the only way they can do that, Dr. Stan, is to get government assistance.
You're absolutely right. Of course, the thing is that government is in bed with the cartels. Now, there are all sorts of government laws against cartels, but they just don't bother to enforce those laws any more than they enforce the laws against commodity speculation in oil, which drove the price up. And so the government goes right along because we have some of the finest politicians money could buy. And this was never to be the function of government, was to protect cartels. The whole idea was to restrict the power of government so people could be free. But in the name of helping the people, and oh, look at the problems, why we want to pass all these laws, and this is not, of course, to provide for competition, although they'll try to convince you of it, is make sure there is no competition. For the people who pay off the politicians, who do you think is putting up the, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars for our presidential campaigns, and the hundreds of millions of dollars for congressional and Senate campaigns? It's not Joe Sixpack, I'll tell you. It is the people of great wealth, and of course, you and I are restricted to giving $1,000 or $2,000. They can give as much as they want to. They have different laws for the very wealthy, and then, of course, then for the common people who have a total disdain for it. Well, Ralph, you go right ahead with the story.
Okay, now let's talk about the first cartel that Dr. Quigley taught Bill Clinton about. It was formed on September 17, 1928, by Royal Dutch Shell, Anglo-Iranian, and Standard Oil. Those were the first three in the cartel. That cartel has grown to where there are seven now of the greatest oil companies forming a cartel. Those three, of course, Anglo-Iranian, Royal Dutch Shell, and Esso, which was a part of the Rockefeller Standard Oil one. Then there was Calso, Standard Oil of California, Saucony Vacuum, later became Mobil, Gulf, and Texaco. Those are what they call the Seven Sisters. And in the 1977 article that I read the quotes from John Ashbrook, there was a comment made by a leading oil industry executive who was not part of the Seven Sisters, but who wanted to remain anonymous for very important reasons, obviously. And he went on to say, where Exxon leads, the other six follow. So now, if that's true, then Exxon controls the Seven Sisters. Well, who controls Exxon? It's the Rockefeller family, the first family in the oil industry, primarily the first one, and also now the controller of the Seven Sisters. Now, you pointed out that there were attempts made to break up these trusts, these huge oil companies, back in 1911. They called it busting the trust, and Congress succeeded. They divided the oil Standard Oil Trust into four separate oil companies, ExxonMobil, Standard of California, and Standard of Indiana, which means we divided the ownership. No, we divided the papers and the stock, because all four of those ended up being controlled by the Rockefellers. So the Rockefellers owned one company, now they own four. So what's the difference? Nothing. Of course, and that's part of the process of how the oil companies are controlled primarily by the Rockefellers, and have been since at least 1911. Okay, now, this cartel, according to Dr. Quigley, controlled 92% of the world's reserves of oil, excluding the United States, the Soviet Union, and Mexico. Now, that means that they were already drilling oil from the Arabian countries. Already, the Seven Sisters were drilling oil in the Arabian countries. Remember that one of the first three companies that formed the cartel in 1928 was called Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. That means that Iran's oil is not owned by Iran. It's owned by a partnership of the government of Iran and the Anglo part. They don't identify it, but it's an Anglo, meaning an English oil company. And we're going to examine who owns OPEC. It's not owned by the Arabians, and we're going to also break a couple of myths that we Americans believe in about OPEC a little later. Now, there are those who believe that the government, of course, is the key to this whole thing, and that's the reason. They're the ones who make sure, because they restrict onshore drilling, offshore drilling, everything else. Now, let's talk about the tax-free foundations. It's interesting to get into this as well. Just briefly, the tax-free foundations were formed prior to the 16th Amendment, the one that apparently, or at least allegedly, created the income tax. So the income tax came in 1913, I believe it was. And prior to that, just a few years before, the tax-free foundations were set up with government approvals that they would not have to pay income tax. And the comments made in this article were that...
Hold that thought, Ralph. We'll be back in just a moment as we bring our other stations on. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ralph Epperson. We're talking about, of course, what's really going on behind the scenes. And, of course, the cartel, the oil cartel, that really started out with three sisters and then went to seven sisters. I think it's down to about six now because Mobil has been bought up by Exxon and Chevron bought Texaco. But it's really the power is in the same hands. The Rockefeller is the predominant power of oil in the world. And then a Royal Dutch Shell, which is controlled by the Royal House of the Netherlands, and British Petroleum, which is leased and partly controlled by the British royal family. But the royalty of America, of course, is the Rockefeller. So you go right ahead with the story.
Okay, now, we were talking about the tax-free foundations. The Rockefellers, of course, were one of the first ones to create tax-free foundations. I think they've got three or four of them, Rockefeller Brothers, Rockefeller or something, I forgot now. But they got into business very quickly to set up, to transfer the ownership of these corporations, the stock, to these tax-free foundations so they didn't pay income tax on their profits. And then they could tap into it through other forms and I guess not pay taxes as well. I'm not sure about that. Anyway, according to this article, it said the Rockefeller Foundations were the leading supporters of the ecology movement.
The environmental movement, of course.
Yes. Now, why? Why would the Rockefellers want to control the ecology movement? And here's a very simple explanation. We have been taught as Americans that we cannot trust the oil industry because they leak the oil, they break pipes, and they cause fires, and they drain oil, and they drop it into the water system, and they spoil things, and they kill birds and everything else. So we've got to control the ecology movement, the oil industry, by not allowing them to drill onshore, offshore, build refineries, or even we'll even limit the amount of carbon dioxide, wherever it is, those oil refineries put out by restricting the amount of oil they can produce. By the way, let's just mention this very briefly. One of our candidates just said he wanted to start offshore, or I think it was offshore drilling, which is very interesting. How's he going to refine that product? Is there any discussion about getting new refineries built? No. So who's going to want to invest to do some offshore drilling without the refining capacity to refine it? I don't understand. If he's going to allow American or presumably American oil companies to do this, to do offshore drilling, you need a refinery. But if they won't let them build one, who's going to do any offshore drilling? Excuse me, John McCain, you need to also set up the procedures to get new refineries built for your new source of oil, to get us away from foreign oil. But John McCain hasn't figured that out yet, apparently, because I've not heard him say anything about refining capacity. Am I missing something, Dr.
Stan? No, I think you're doing fine. Go right ahead, Ralph.
So that explains a great deal. The Rockefellers are the ones who are running the ecology movement to scare us about the oil industry, so we'll seek foreign oil.
Well, through anything, Ralph, what they want, of course, is monopoly. What they wanted was to use the power of government to stop competition. That's what it's all about, and they create artificial shortages. The Rockefellers, of course, the people who control the environmental movement, why do the Rockefellers want to finance the environmental movement? Very simply, the environmental movement then would stop the building of new refineries, would stop the use of nuclear power. It would certainly stop the exploration by their competitors. It was all about controlling the competition. Would you agree?
No, Dutch, then it's bigger than that.
All right, fine.
And we're going to end with that. Please bear with me, because I've got a very interesting quote to read at the very end to show you why this is all happening. It's
all right.
Far bigger than just destroying competition. They've already done that for 50 years. They've done it right now. They're in total charge of the oil industry around the world. So that's it. Let's spread fears about the oil industry, and let's not trust them, so therefore we can not allow them to build refineries or drill anywhere else. Now let's also talk about James P. Warburg. This is really interesting. The son of Paul Warburg, one of the Warburg banking houses, and one of the creators of the Federal Reserve. As you know, Paul Warburg was at Jekyll Island, as I remember. In fact, I even think maybe he wrote one of the bills. I don't remember. But he's a major player. This is the son of him, a very prolific writer. He's written something like 25 books prior to the book that I read in 1959 called The West in Crisis. And I read that book, and in there, he reveals more than he was supposed to, I think. He wrote 25 books between 1920 and 1958, and he was also one of the advisors to Vice President Wallace when Franklin Roosevelt was president. So he was an economic advisor and a PhD, and he wrote these books for us to read later, of course. Here's what he wrote. 8 giant oil companies. This is written in 1959. That's also significant for a reason I'll point out in a minute. 8 giant oil companies, 5 of them American, control the non-communist world supply of oil, maintaining administered prices which yield exorbitant profits. The oil companies extract...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Ralph Everson. Ralph, go right ahead. You were telling us about James Warburg and this book he had written talking about the massive profits that the oil companies are making.
It's also one more thing we've got to understand, Dr. Stan, is that they were already drilling oil in the Arabian countries. That's very, very important for a reason we'll point out in a minute. Okay, now, he wrote this book in 1959. He says that these oil companies control the non-communist world supply of oil, maintaining administered prices which yield exorbitant profits. And then he went on to point out the oil companies extract oil from the Middle East, which contains 90% of the known reserves of the non-communist world. So this was written in 1959, just before OPEC was created in 1960. So what he's saying is that suddenly, after this statement, the Seven Sisters, which were already drilling oil in the Middle East, they decided to turn over all of that oil profits to the Arabian countries because they formed OPEC. That's what we've been taught, but that's not true, unfortunately, as we're going to learn. We're going to learn who really does own OPEC, and we're going to see how it fits into what's happening to our gas prices today. Okay, now, Mr. Warburg went on to point out how they make this exorbitant profit. This was stunning to me. When I found this probably in about the 70s someplace, I was stunned because here he is putting it in writing how much of an exorbitant profit they made. He reported that their cost was 20 to 30 cents a barrel, and then they sold the barrel for $1.75 to $2.16. Now, let's just use the high figures. Let's take 30 cents a barrel, and they sell it for $2.16. That means they made a profit of $1.86. That's a 628% profit. 628% profit. Now, I know, Dr. Stan, you're a very wise investor with your money, and you get 600% interest on your money, don't you?
I only wish I did.
Yes. Would you call a 628% profit a... exorbitant profits?
I would agree with you, Robin, totally.
I had some fun with those figures, and this is purely arbitrary. I cannot certify that I did anything except just take a guess and hope. But I started thinking, well, wait a minute, let's take the 30 cents and increase it by 5% a year inflation. Let's just presume that inflation eats up and maybe wage increases, I don't know. But I decided to increase the 30 cents by 5% from 1959 to 2008, and I ended up with a cost per barrel of...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course Ralph is simply pointing out that the oil companies were getting the oil out of the ground over in the Arabian area for 20, 30 cents. 30 cents would be high, but 30 cents a barrel. And they were selling it for a couple of dollars a barrel. They were making a good profit. And of course, they've been doing this sort of thing, and then he was suggesting that we've had inflation there, maybe 5% a year. And so since the late 1950s until... over almost 50 years from now. So what was your suggestion, Ralph? What's the thought?
Okay, now let's take the 30 cents, increase it 5% a year, purely arbitrarily, and ended up with $5 a barrel. It's how much it cost them to produce it. And this was when they're selling the barrel price was about $105. So I took 105 minus 5. That's a $100 profit on a $5 investment, which is now a 2,000% profit. 2,000%. I would also call that an exorbitant profit, but praise God, Dr. Stan, you might remember George W. said a couple of years ago when the prices were up around probably $2 or $3 a gallon, he said, if I find anyone making an exorbitant profit on this oil transactions, I'll stop it. Well, I hate to say it, he's done nothing about it, so I guess he doesn't feel that a 2,000% profit is exorbitant.
One thing I think George Bush, of course, did everything he could to aggravate this. He kept the ban on offshore drilling on until really for almost 8 years. The ban his father put on in 1990 President George Bush's father, and now George Bush, only in June of this year did he actually lift that ban on offshore drilling. And it was all show business. He knows very well lifting the ban is not going to do anything for 5 to 10 years on the availability of oil. But it's all show biz to convince the people that he's really trying to do something, because a lot of people were concerned because he had instructed the Commerce Department to buy oil, and that oil was put in the National Reserve. Millions of barrels of oil went into the National Strategic Reserve under President George Bush's instructions, all the while that the price was rising. He didn't buy it when it was cheap. He bought it when it was expensive and helped drive the price up. Now, they've stopped that at the present time. Now, of course, we've reached almost a crisis situation. Before we go on, Ralph, I'd like you to get out your website. I'd like you to get out your telephone number so people would know how to get in touch with you and get the material you offer.
Okay. This DVD is called $10 a Gallon Gasoline, and it's available. You can watch it on Google Video. If you know how to go to Google Video, type in $10 a gallon and then click on search, and it'll come up with a list of others. And you find the one called $10 a Gallon by Epperson. Click on that. It's an hour and 17 minutes long. You can watch it for free. And, by the way, make copies. And I'm urging you to do this. I want to make this point very clear, Dr. Stan. I believe this, after 40 years of research, this is the most serious crisis this nation has ever faced, and we're going to see why when we end. I'm telling you, this has the more potential to destroy this country than anything else you could have, maybe short of a nuclear war. That's how serious this thing is. If we don't stop this price to go to from $5 to $10 to $15 or even more, I don't know where it's going to end up. If we don't stop this, we the people, this thing is going to have a deleterious effect upon this whole United States, and that's, by the way, what it's being done for. Bill O'Reilly on the O'Reilly Fox News said on June the 14th, 2008, it cost Saudi Arabia about $2 to market each barrel of oil, and he said that. I got it on tape. I saved it. Now, that is when the barrel price was $138 a barrel. That's a 6,800% profit. That's not too shabby either, is it?
Nope.
6,800% profit. But, by the way, just notice, since that was said just a couple of weeks ago, George W. decided to step in and stop it. Remember, he promised us he would do that, and he's done nothing. And I think that's significant.
All right, you go right ahead.
Now, the next, the most well-known cartel is called OPEC, which stands for the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, and was formed, as I said, in 1960. There are 13 member nations. Now, this was, I guess I got this about 6 months ago, and I still think it's the state. The list is probably still there.
I think there's one. One of the countries has dropped out, but I think there's 12 at the present time. But you're right. There were 13. So go ahead. Who are, do you want to talk
let's
about?
Tell,
who there?
I want to name them. Algeria, Ecuador, Gabon, which I think is in Africa, Indonesia. I'm sorry. One page too many. Iran, Iraq, Kuwait, Libya, Nigeria, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Venezuela. Now, I'm not very good at determining who's an Arabian country, but my quick perusal of that said there were seven. If there's seven part of 13, that's the controlling, they're the majority. And if they're all colluding together, that means that the seven could control the entire OPEC organization. But I'm going to prove to you that OPEC is not owned by the majority of the seven or any other of the 13. It's owned and controlled by the seven sisters. And that is what I'm going to try to prove in the next few minutes. Okay, now, I've got two assumptions to discuss that we, the American people, have been lied to and we believe. We have been taught that OPEC is controlled by the Arabians. And so whenever we talk about OPEC and they're raising the price, it's always the Arabians doing that to us. And I just pointed out that maybe seven, maybe eight of the 13 are Arabians. The other five or six, or whatever it is, are not. So that's not true. The Arabians are not controlling OPEC. Second, we believe that we only import oil from OPEC nations, and that's not true. I used a government source on this, and I'm going to now list the names of the nations that sell us the oil. And you'll see that most of them, not most, but probably four or five out of the eight or ten I'm going to quote, are non-OPEC nations. These are ranked in the importance of their contributions of their oil to us. Canada, Saudi Arabia, Mexico, Nigeria, Venezuela, Iraq, Angola, and there's seven more, each of which sends us 250,000 of barrels a day or less. So they're not significant, because the first one, Canada, sells us 1,800 thousands of barrels every day.
So 1.82 million, I think, is the figure. And we consume about, we used to consume about 20.5 million barrels of gasoline a day, and of oil, I should say, a day. And now we're down to about 19.5 or 7 million barrels of oil per day. But you're absolutely right. Canada is the largest supplier. And then, of course, the Mexicans, I think, are the second largest. Oh, Russia. Is it Russia in there? Are we buying a great deal of oil from Russia, do you know?
Well, they weren't listed in this report that was published by the government.
All right, fine. So basically, then, what's the second one? We have Canada, we have Saudi Arabia, then we have Mexico.
That's
go
right.
ahead.
And Nigeria.
Right.
And Venezuela. Okay, now, when I total this up, and we get 55% of our oil from OPEC nations. That means we get 45% from non-OPEC nations.
Remember, Chris, we actually produce 8 million barrels per day right here in the United States. So then if we import about 60% of our oil, we produce 40% of our oil. And that 60% we import, why most of that, only maybe a little over half of that comes from OPEC. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, the figures I used when I developed this from the government was 55% comes from OPEC. 45% does not. But here's the interesting question, Dr. Stan, that I have never heard anybody ask. Why do the non-OPEC nations raise their prices when the OPEC nations do? Now, the OPEC nations have a contract. They have to. They have to agree. But the non-OPEC nations don't have to agree, do they? Now, notice this. We don't seem to care about that or wonder about that. Well, I want to know because the non-OPEC nations could hold the price at that level and let the OPEC nations raise their price. And then you and I would see the difference, and we'd go to the non-OPEC nations and buy our gas from them. And that would cause an enormous storage problem for the OPEC nations. What are they going to do? They're going to have to somehow find a way to market that oil, and the way is to reduce the price. So now we're going to learn who controls by name which oil companies control OPEC and even the non-OPEC nations, and we're going to see the same names pop up as, again, the Seven Sisters. And that's why the non-OPEC nations raise their prices when the OPEC nations do. Isn't that interesting? And notice, some of these companies are owned specifically by Americans. So the next question is, why would American oil companies want to rip us off to the tune, as we heard today from Exxon, what, $11 billion of profit in one quarter? Why would they do that? We're all friends here. We're all Americans, aren't we? American companies are doing this to us with the collusion of the American government. We're supposed to, wait a minute, our government buy the people from, no, Ralph, you don't understand. There's a cartel, and the cartel is controlled, is in collusion with the government. Now, that's the problem. Let's continue. I'm flipping through my notes here, Dr. Stan. This, by the way, this DVD is only an hour and about 17 minutes long, and it's available free. If you want a copy, it's $10 plus two for postage. I'm not charging much for it. I'm just trying to cover enough because I'm giving them away. I want you to know this, Dr. Stan. The only way we can save this nation from this thing is to get this DVD out as quickly as we can and to people of influence, which means people who can, like you, Dr. Stan, you've got a listening audience. We've got to tell the American people this is what's happening and let them decide it's time for us all to get active. And you've got to find professors in colleges, high schools, principals, people who own radio and TV networks or stations, deans of colleges, corporation heads, big people who can get this information into the hands of the mass numbers quickly because they've got the money. If we don't stop this, Dr. Stan, we're going to learn what the purpose is a little later. So that's the question. Why does the non-OPEC nations raise their prices as well? And I don't understand. Yes, I do. I know. Now, why would they use oil to affect the marketplace? And the answer is oil is the foundation of the American economy. Everything we do is based upon oil. I can't think of one industry that's free of oil in some regard. Trucking. Everything's trucked all over this country. See trucks going north and trucks going south. And they're trucking. That's oil. Railroads run on oil. Medicines, some of them were made from oil. Paper bags, plastic bags, you name it, work it, everything. That's why they decided to use oil to bring this free market economy down. And that's why they're doing this, as we're going to see. So oil is the key to this whole thing. Now, there's two more words I want to use and get your listeners hopefully using them as well. They're discretionary spending and non-discretionary spending. And let's define those, because this is understanding what's happening in America right now. Non-discretionary spending is defined as spending that we have no control over, which means we buy a house, we get a mortgage payment, and if we don't pay our mortgage payment, we lose our house. So you have to make that payment each month to keep your house. You've got to pay your taxes each month or really they're due. You've got to pay your taxes. Food might probably be at least the majority of it. You can certainly cut down and stop eating steaks and eat hamburgers or something. You can reduce that a little bit, but that's also a non-discretionary spending. The rest of the money that's left over is called discretionary. You can decide not to go to the pizza parlor, not to go to the theater, not to go to a baseball game, not to take that trip to grandma's house for a vacation. So that's discretionary spending. Now, in my DVD, I point out, let's just presume it's 50-50. 50% of your money is spent on discretionary spending and 50% on non-discretionary, and suddenly your gas prices go up. What do you do? Well, you could decide, if you can, to reduce your gas consumption, but if you need your car and it's pretty much consistent each month, that means you've got to dip in discretionary spending. which means you're not going to go to the pizza parlor, not going to go to the movies, you're not going to go to the baseball game or whatever, or buy the newspaper, pay your cable company. You're going to cancel it. And then it goes up again, and you're going to take more of your discretionary spending. And if this continues, Dr. Stan, whole industries are going to shut down because there'll be less money available to spend on those services and products. That's the key. Now, if they can get it up to, you know, about 25% of your money is for discretionary spending and 75% for non-discretionary spending, pizza parlors are going to shut down, newspapers are going to shut down, cable companies are going to shut down. And when that happens, unemployment goes up. And when that goes up, they go to the government for that benefit called unemployment insurance, and they get those that money. Where does that come from? It comes from your non-discretionary spending. That goes up another step. That means less money to go to the pizza parlor or the whatever. And I'm telling you, this whole economy is going to change if it gets to $10 a gallon. Whole industries are going to go shut down, and whole marketplaces are going to shut down. It's that serious. That's why this is crucial. Okay, now, let's talk about what happens to the profits made by the companies first. Let's remind you of what Mr. Warburg said in his book. By the way, I want to mention this, since we've got a few seconds here. Jimmy Carter did his bit in 1978. I want to give this man credit. I found a little article in my local newspaper, and I show it on my DVD. You can see it with your own eyes. It says, in June of 1978, President Carter proposed to move our nation, quote now, this is now quoting the article, toward true energy abundance with readily available energy supplies. Oh, man, that's what he should have done, or should do, and he did it. What did he do? Now, going on to point out that Jimmy Carter installed solar panels on the roof of the White House. Now, that's the way to make energy supplies readily available. I think, Dr. Stan, I think we should nominate Jimmy Carter for the Nobel Peace Prize.
In fact, what I want to do is get a solar panel put on my car so that I wouldn't have to use gasoline. Of course, all of these things are so ridiculous. I mean, certainly we are oil dependent for the time being until they come up with an alternative fuel. And believe me, they're not working on alternative fuels because, of course, your oil company's got a pretty good thing going. Well, of course, our guest has been Ralph Everson. Ralph, one more time, get your telephone number out there.
800-422-3888. Call me, get a copy of this DVD, get it off the internet. Let's get it out to as many people as we can.
All right. Well, Ralph is on the front lines of this battle. He recognized the power elite, of which masonry is one part, but of course there are many other parts to this cabal that really runs things from behind the scenes. And the Masons interlock with the Rosicrucians and the Theosophists and the Council on Foreign Relations, because after all, both Cecil Rhodes and Lord Milner, who created the secret society, came out of masonry. But that's another story for another time. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program right here with Ralph Everson. Ralph, go right ahead.
Okay, now, let's just mention again. By the way, are we going to do an hour and a half, Dr. Stan?
No, we're just about done. You've got the 3 minutes before
we wrap up the program, right? I won't be able to do it except from memory then. If you want to call me to get the DVD, 800-422-3888. I have a website, RalphEpperson.com. The one word, RalphEpperson with two P's, .com. Go there or go to Google Videos, type in $10 a gallon, and watch my DVD. Let me summarize what this thing is all about. I want to use the book called The Third Wave by Irving...
Toffler.
Toffler.
Right.
It's not Irving, it's something else. Alvin Toffler.
Alvin Toffler, right.
That book is incredible, and I quote it. I was stunned when I read this book probably 15 years ago. No, whenever it came out, 96 or something. He says, and I'm going to make it very brief, this energy crisis situation is part of a plan to destroy the free enterprise system.
Now, who said that?
Mr. Toffler.
All right, fine.
In The Third Wave. And I quote it. I show you the words. That is the purpose of this. But even that is only a part of a bigger plan, which is the New World Order. That is what this is all about. And that's why I want you to know it's time, it's coming, it's on the way, it's happening in front of our eyes right now. If we don't get busy to stop this thing, Dr. Stan, it's going to destroy not only the free enterprise system, but this nation.
Well, a friend of mine just got back from Germany. Gasoline is $9 a gallon over in Germany. And, of course, people are really hurting over there. The people are really under pressure, and their living standards is just going down in large part because of that. And, of course, most of that is taxation. It has nothing to do with the price of oil. The price of oil goes up, the taxes go up $9 a gallon. Well, will it happen here? We're just about out of time. Go ahead. You got about a minute left, Ralph.
Just to summarize, go to Google Video, please. We've got to get busy, all of us. It's time for us to put an end to the New World Order. The Novus Ordo Seclorum on the back of your dollar bill that I've been talking about since 1985, and you have, I know, as well, Dr. Stan. We've got to, that's what this thing is all about. It's time. The child that was born in 1782 is now becoming an adult. It's time for all of us to get busy to stop this gas price. And we've got to make it known to the American people who they can put the pressure on government to stop it. Blow the whistle on these rascals and put a stop to this, and we start doing it right today.
Well, our guest has been Ralph Everson. Ralph, are you available Monday morning at 7 o'clock?
Yes.
Ralph. All right, fine. I'll call you. We plan on doing a program there, and I'll give you a call tomorrow and verify it. And Ralph will be on our other programs very soon. Bye-bye. Good night. God bless. Okay, fine. Well, of course, that was Ralph Everson. That was Ralph Everson. We hope you enjoyed our program with him. If you want to get any views on what's going on as far as the phony shortage of oil, it is a phony shortage of oil. All of this is manipulated. We've got two products. We have one called The Oil Deception. It's a 4-tape, a 4-CD set. And, of course, the second one is a copy of the DVD put out by Lindsay Williams called The Energy Non-Crisis. Now, Lindsay has been threatened and is not allowed to talk about what is in this DVD. And, of course, everything is being done to suppress information. There is no shortage of energy. This whole problem has been created. It is all because of manipulation on the commodity market. First of all, if you'd like information on the truth about the energy non-crisis, we have a couple of newsletters, the September and October 2005 Radio Liberty Letters. September and October 2005 Radio Liberty Letters. You can pull them down off the Internet for nothing, or if you get any of the other products and specifically request those newsletters, we'll send them to you. The September and October 2005 newsletters, Radio Liberty newsletters, Peak Oil and the Myth of Peak Oil, or Peak Oil 2. So understand that this is all contrived. But there's a method in their madness. Certainly when Lee Raymond, who was the CEO of Standard Oil, of Exxon, retired back in 2005, he got a little bonus, $400 million, and that was just sort of a going away present, in addition to, of course, all his regular salaries. This is the way the system works, and the rich get richer, the poor get poorer. When you understand that the whole idea is to create a feudal system with a very rich group of people and a very impoverished people, and they intend to wipe out the middle class, so much of what's going on really makes sense. Now, if you don't believe there's a master plan, you need to get our sustainable development syllabus. That's the sustainable development syllabus. I suggest you get the DVD, A Sustainable Development, The Road to World Government, along with it. But there in the syllabus, you can read the Earth Charter. You can read the Population Control Agenda monograph. You can read the Global Biodiversity Assessment, the summary of that, where they talk about the importance of lowering living standards throughout the world. And, of course, the people they have to lower the most are the people at their highest. And that is you, ladies and gentlemen. They intend to steal everything you've got through the process of inflation, and these things are all underway, and it's very, very soon. Your pension fund, your insurance policies, your annuities, everything you've done, of course, is to look after yourself in your old age, will simply become a remembrance of things past. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. Get the Sustainable Development Syllabus and read the Master Plan. We even have there, of course, the Master Plan from the Georgia Guidestones, these satanic monuments in Elberton, Georgia. And if you'd like to know more about them, there's an excellent article this week on WorldNet Daily about the monuments, the effort to destroy the monuments. I don't think it's going to work because I don't think Satan will allow them to come down. Right now, he's in charge here on this earth. But God's people can influence what's going on and hopefully pray for revival and pray for God's intervention. For indeed, we're involved in a spiritual battle. And people think that it's had anything to do with Exxon or Chevron or Royal Dutch Shell or British Petroleum or Total or Conoco. They don't understand. This is a spiritual battle being fought on a petroleum and oil cartel battlefield, on the political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational battlefield. We have the information. You go to our website, radioliberty.com. You can pull out on our newsletters on the oil fiasco. You can pull down our newsletters on Sybil Edmonds, which gives you the background of the coming nuclear war with the Muslim world, where the United States government has intentionally transferred nuclear technology and nuclear equipment to Pakistan so they could build nuclear weapons, so they could give, of course, to the Muslims so we can have a nuclear war. All these things are coming. We're living in exciting times. Please go to our website, radioliberty.com, give us a call, 1-800-544-8927, and pray for Radio Liberty.